You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Chicago, 1937. A group of men approach the property of a steel mill. They're not strangers. This is their place of work. But they aren't going to work today. They are going to the Republic Mill to picket, protest, and keep out replacement steelworkers. These men are members of the new Steelworkers Organizing Committee, a branch of the CIO. Unlike other scattered radical upstarts of the past, unlike the strikes of 1919 in Chicago, where the steel strike was beaten down, this group is more organized. The SWOC. Steelworkers Organizing Committee was comprised of all skill levels of steelwork, all races, all neighborhoods of Chicago's Protestant and Catholic, immigrant and native-born. They had newsletters, alert chains, even family picnics and bowling nights where the members would bond. There was even a CIO radio program weekly. And as they charged forward together, they knew that they represented a powerful new union, a veritable new model army of labor, forged like the metal they worked with from the mistakes and successes of America's labor past. But they had something else, a friend in the White House, the most pro-labor president ever. And they'd already wrenched concessions from America's largest steelmaker, U.S. Steel. Everything seemed to be right, yet it would all go wrong. When U.S. Steel gave in, this left Little Steel in Chicago, the smaller companies with lower profit margins. Republic Steel was the toughest, and its owner stopped talking to the union entirely. As they approached the mill, unified, confident, guards ordered them off the property. They refused. The guards fired, and 10 steel workers lie dead. To labor, it was the Memorial Day massacre. To business, it was an attempt to control their own property, albeit with violence. Even labor's friend, Franklin Roosevelt, responded with a pox on both your houses speech, and there would be no win against Republic Steel until 1943. Things worked better in 1912 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, when a new law was passed that said women could only work 54 hours a week. The mill responded by paying women less. When a group of Polish immigrant women found that their envelopes were shorted, they walked out. And the next day, 10,000 workers joined them. Workers went from the American woolen mill to the duck mill to the Washington mill, each time grabbing and gathering more strikers. Militia were called to protect the mills. The workers then called in the International Workers of the World, the IWW, the so-called Wobblies. It was the only union that would take anyone at any skill level, any race, any nationality, any gender. There were 25 nationalities working in the mills in Lawrence. There were Greeks, Serbians, Portuguese, Franco-Belgians, Syrians. And the IWW organized them all. They had a leader for each nationality. When a woman striker was shot and police blamed the strikers, the police banned public meetings and arrested the leaders of the IWW that were in Lawrence. The IWW sent the national leaders, including Big Bill Haywood. And they held a giant public meeting in defiance of the law. We are conducting the most violent strike, the violence of keeping your mouth shut and putting your hands in your pocket and denying them your labor, Bill Hayward said. Let them weave cloth with bayonets. The crowd went wild. Soup kitchens were established. The workers sent their children away to New York City, where there were willing families lined up by the IWW to take them in. A great PR move, as it turned out. All over the newspapers, there were scenes of mothers giving up their children, putting them on the train while they fought for their wages. When they tried to send another train and put more children on the trains, the militia and the police blocked the trains, beat parents, and pulled children away. This generated a lot of negative publicity, some nasty photographs, and eventually a congressional investigation, which was attended by First Lady Helen Taft. Bad news for the mill owners. One by one, they gave in with raises and less hours for the workers. The Great Railroad Strike of 1877 was not so organized. There was no union. Yet something happened. When a strike started with a group of workers in Baltimore, it spread up to Cumberland, Maryland, spread down the rail line. The governor sent in the militia, and then civilians in Baltimore supporting the workers attacked the militia before they could get to Cumberland to stop the strike. There was a pitched battle opening up in the streets of Baltimore. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, railroad workers walked off the job and set fires to railroads in Center City. In Pittsburgh, strikers stopped trains. Local police wouldn't touch the workers. And President Hayes was forced to send troops. This made him really popular, I'm sure, with the working class. Finally, the strike spread to Chicago. Papers blared that the town was being taken over by a howling mob of cutthroats. The mayor asked for vigilantes to put the strike down. It was an unsuccessful strike, this railroad strike of 1877. But a warning to the railroads and an early sign that American labor, even underground, even unorganized, is not always demure. Indeed, American history is tied up with these struggles between workers and the people that employ them, a constant threat of unrest, suppression, concession, or submission. The rich fabric has given labor in the political discussions of 2011 iconic status, mixed with the fact that some of our fathers, some of our grandmothers, and many of us were in unions. Maybe we've been in unions. And they just take on the status of religions in our politics. That dollar in your paycheck on Friday, that was the result of a steel worker lying on the ground. That week of vacation, thank a union worker for that, buddy. Yet we live in a world where unions are dying. In one sense, they represent less than 8% of private sector workers. What's going on? When did unions start in the United States? I have trouble answering it. Did it begin with the New Deal? With the first Secretary of Labor in 1913? With that railroad strike I talked about? With the first working man's candidate for president in 1876? With the time that a working man's party ran labor candidates and briefly beat Andrew Jackson's henchmen in Tammany Hall in New York in the 1820s? When young women at mills in Lowell, Massachusetts walked off the job in the 1830s? When did unions begin? When would they become part of our politics? Truth is, labor strife began before the Constitution and perhaps even before the Revolution. Yes, it was a farming country, but there was plenty of pre-industrial age work going on. Artisans and mechanics, shoemakers, blacksmiths, masons, coopers, cobblers, tinsmiths. These were some of the people who you would see sometimes in groups in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. Skilled workers. Sure, it was a farming country, but there needed to be tools. These were the men that made them, and they didn't always just sit quietly alone. Skilled workers. Printers and typographs led the Stamp Act protests of the 1760s. After all, that tax imposed by the British government affected their work directly. And these would be some of the same people who would unionize early. The men who were shot in the Boston Massacre were dock workers, and the strife was initially started when a British soldier tried to get a side job in dock work and take it from one of the locals. Even the British Army didn't pay enough to its workers. Relations between craftsmen, their masters, and these journeymen and apprentices. Journeyman is a word that goes back to when a journey was a day's pay. It doesn't seem like much of a journey. Relations between their masters and the journeymen were not always good. In 1765, in New York, a group of tailors walked off the job at different employers and formed their own shop. It was a kind of free market protest, I suppose. In 1785, shoemakers struck over wages. Employers reacted by forming their own combination. This is 1785. Constitution hadn't even been founded yet, and you already had the basic elements of a labor struggle. By the turn of the century, New York, almost all the major crafts had groups, brotherhood, guilds, whatever you wanted to call them. Cabinet makers had one. Caulkers, coopers, cordwainers, tailors, carpenters, masons, they all had craft groups. Some had sick funds. Some had fraternal parties, some sponsored lectures or education, and many of them set standards of work, you know, had messages like don't get drunk on the job. But they could do more. In 1809, the Printers' Union negotiated collectively and set rules with the printing houses. Mutual duties of both sides to be performed were established. That's when things were really nicey-nice, at least in that union, because printers and the print workers and typographs were all in the same club. This union actually allowed the printing owners of the printing houses in. In 1804, New York tailors boycotted low-paying employers. It wasn't a general strike. It wasn't a strike against all the employers, just at certain employers, and that was very common in this era. In 1810, carpenters struck. In 1808, it was the cordwainers. In 1819, masons. And we come to 1825, and the hatters struck, prompting the hatteries to sue the Hatters Guild for conspiracy. Indeed, the court case, the lockout, the blacklist, all of these employer tactics were visible by the 1820s in America. Between the Constitution being passed in 1825, you had at least 25 strikes in New York. So that when I say the first true national American labor union, or when your history teacher tells you that the first true national American labor union was the Knights of Labor of the 1880s, a group with 700,000 members across the country spread like wildfire, skilled and unskilled, you will know that while it's true, it doesn't represent the first organization of workers in America. Workers have been banding together in some kind of collective action for all of American history. Maybe they always have. Maybe they always will. The Knights were visibly crew-fast, and they started a demand for an 8-hour workday, among other things. Yet when it became associated with the Haymarket Square bombings in Chicago, where police officers were killed, right or wrong, was associated with that, and it lacked the authority to control jurisdictional disputes between smaller unions, which union was the one that would actually represent any given factory. It fell out of favor, just couldn't get the job done. But as soon as it ended, about 1886, didn't really end, but it sort of petered out, a branch of it lasted much longer. That started by Samuel Gompers, cigar worker. He started the AFL, or the American Federation of Labor. This was intended to be a calmer, even more conservative group than the Knights had been, focusing on just the cream of the crop, the skilled workers. Gompers supported World War I, for instance, calling it labor's war and encouraging men to participate. He also, as best he could, kept the AFL out of party politics for those very partisan turn-of-the-century times, at least in the early part of the organization's history, not wanting to offend either side. In contrast, and in competition with the AFL, were the Wobblies, we discussed earlier in the Lawrence strike, the International Workers of the World. They were far more aggressive. They took workers in any field, any skill level, any race, and any gender. They supported socialist candidates rather than the two parties. Had some wins. There was the Lawrence strike we mentioned. And in 1917, they won an eight-hour day for lumberjacks in Washington State. They really became the most feared among employers. While they were crushed in the Patterson textile mill strike, they won wage increases for stevedores in Philadelphia and raised millions in the cities to support their cause. An IWW worker might ride the rails with a bag with $1,000 of organizing money. In fact, soon some of the employers got together and would hire detectives or big burly men to go through all of the rail cars where migrant workers would be and look for these organizers. The IWW, in turn, had groups that would look for the henchmen or the detectives, and when one was found, they would be sure to mark him in a lasting way with the letters IWW. It wasn't a pretty battle between the Wobblies and the employers. They won tiny victories, like ending the practice where line managers would take a cut of each migratory worker's wage off the top. The IWW, through legal and perhaps some violent methods, ended the practice. "We got 'em pretty good," one worker said in a 1970s documentary about the Wobblies. World War I was particularly difficult for this group. They took no position on the war, but after the war, in the ensuing Red Scare and the Palmer Raids, the organization was destroyed. Bill Haywood, its leader, fled to Russia. That looked great for the organization.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And the leaders that were left were indicted, and the headquarters was burnt and ransacked. The AFL fared better. In 1907, it broke its bipartisan stance, and Samuel Gompers cemented a deal with the Democratic Party, resulting in its endorsement in 1908 of William Jennings Bryan. This was his third run for the presidency and not successful. But in 1912, the AFL was more successful in helping Wilson in a tight three-way race and got his gratitude. After a visit from Gompers, the president signed the Clayton Act, which permitted unions. Unions were never officially established in legality in the United States until then. It said that you could not use anti-conspiracy and you could not use antitrust acts to stop unions from striking. This was the legal weapon that employers were using to get injunctions against unions. Gompers would call it labor's Magna Carta. Didn't really work out that way, but Wilson's Democrats, with his help, would hold the House in 1914, and he would be narrowly reelected. These victories helped cement labor's connection with the Democratic Party. So maybe that explains why there is no Labor Party in the United States the way you have in the United Kingdom and in Australia, the Labor Party. The truth is that Dem-Labor connection, from a historical perspective, is fairly new. Labor, at first instance, would not find a lot in common with the conservative Democratic Party of the 19th century. When Eugene Debs and the American Railway Union started a strike on Pullman cars, which meant that most cars were being struck against in 1893, they crippled rail traffic. Grover Cleveland, Democratic president, saw it as a disruption of the mail service, and he called the U.S. Marshals in, ended the strike, beat the strikers. The union was destroyed. Debs and others were jailed. And those who wanted their jobs back had to renounce the union and plead with the Pullman Company. Indeed, a Republican, not a Democrat, Theodore Roosevelt, was the first president to elevate a union head to a presidential level when he invited John Lewis of the Mine Workers Union to meet with mine owners in the White House to work out a bitter coal strike that would have the nation freezing by winter Of course, Theodore Roosevelt's action wasn't so novel. His predecessor, William McKinley, faced the exact same scenario in 1900. In fact, during this time, when coal was gas, when it was electric, when it was everything, the coal miners knew that they could get some action for their demands if they struck right before the winter season, particularly in 1900 when McKinley was facing re-election. So he also helped to broker a deal, except he did it through emissaries. Theodore Roosevelt did it in person and was much more visible, causing mine owners to back Alton Parker, his conservative Democratic opponent, in 1904. Even Woodrow Wilson, Democrat and labor's great friend, still didn't hesitate over sending federal troops to destroy a mine workers' settlement, an encampment on a mine during a strike in 1914. Unions and politics, all politicians saw in workingmen votes. The first revolutionaries, as we talked about, were the artisans, the first really active ones, the supporters of the Constitution in some places, like, for instance, in the heated contest, the big state of New York. The big supporters, one of the groups that supported it, were the mechanics. And I don't mean mechanics like auto mechanics, obviously. We just mean it in the old sense of person using tools, mechanics and artisans. They saw federalism as empowering their work and protecting them from foreign imports. But these same mechanics and artisans, politically active in that direction, also helped out the Republicans, the early Republicans, the Jeffersonians, if you will, and joined those clubs. Even back then, you couldn't keep the working man down. The New Deal clarified Democrats as the, quote, Labor Party, and you can see that it's visible how labor has always kind of had this dual power, striking for economic power and activity for political power. The Republicans, after the New Deal, took firmly the anti-labor spot, something that they wouldn't have had so much, let's say, in the McKinley Theodore Roosevelt days, when there would have been posters appealing to working men about their high tariff policies. But by the time you got to 1946, Taft-Hartley, which curbed union powers, was passed by the newly minted Republican Congress. It was one of three bills that between 1930 and 1950 were passed to give some structure to what was going on between labor and employers. First was Norris LaGuardia, named after two progressive Republicans who were New Dealers. The latter became mayor of New York City, you may know. And it ended the question of legality and union activity. We talked about the Clayton Act. The problem was the courts didn't really recognize the Clayton Act. So Norris LaGuardia made unions absolutely legal, and you could not call an injunction against a union strike if you were an employer unless they got violent. It was the Wagner Act that created the National Labor Relations Board that would give federal recognition to unions, both to settle some of the jurisdiction squabbles so that the federal government would say, this is the union, and there are many of these, and also to settle disputes between employers and unions that could cripple industry. As a result of these laws, labor was arm in arm with the New Deal. The president wants you to organize, one Chicago CIO pamphlet said during the 30s. Franklin Roosevelt won big numbers with labor, and Truman got reelected with the urban members in critical states in his tough reelect of 1948. Clark Clifford, who was then a young advisor to Harry Truman, said he could not win without active labor, could not win if labor stayed home. Truman made a big show of vetoing Taft-Hartley, but he was never able to repeal the law, and it still remains law today. But one place was never unionized during the New Deal or during Truman. One place escaped the voice of these very vocal supporters of labor, and that was the part that they controlled, the federal government. In the 1950s, some 65% of people in Gallup polls supported labor unions. Not shocking, because 30% were in unions, 30% of workers. Ford worked with the United Auto Workers to provide unemployment insurance, one of many gains for workers during the 1950s. The AFL and the CIO joined together to create a more powerful group and eliminate all the bickering that was going on. There were well-known cases of corruption, the Teamsters and the bakery workers, but these unions were kicked out of the AFL-CIO for their corrupt activities. See, they said, it's working. We can police ourselves. By 1962, with 75% of Gallup-surveyed people supporting unions, President John F. Kennedy had a political winner, and he signed an executive order, 10988, that allowed unions in the federal government.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I abhor the straight chronological history on this program, as history's taught in school and probably can't be taught any other way but chronologically. I understand that, but doesn't need to be done on a podcast. Why? Because chronological teaching, chronological history leads to linear thinking. The idea that things just get better over time and we live in a progressive world. Just wait a little while, things will get better. Yes, in this case, though, I've done a little bit of this chronology. I just had to. Slow decline, the late 60s, 70s, and 80s as unions force inflating wage increases, help perhaps to drive New York City to bankruptcy. All that publicity surrounding Jimmy Hoffa, where did he go? Economists coming up with alternative theories about what labor unions do, perhaps culminating with the extraordinary demands of government workers, the air traffic controllers, and the PATCO strike, Reagan's subsequent showdown, and Reagan's decision to replace those government workers with replacement air traffic controllers. Leading to the question, was Ronnie just standing up against a union, or was he sending a signal? If he was, someone might have gotten the message. Many companies, including Louisiana Pacific, a lumber company, used replacement workers. A decline in strikes happened, a decline in union membership, the rise of Walmart, and where we are today, jobs going to right-to-work states and to other countries. Increased union avoidance activity at major companies. That's the world we're in today. It's a nice narrative, but I'll dissect it and chop it up a little bit myself, since I don't like chronological narratives. Unions didn't just start in the post-Civil War era. They're pretty active where the work was being done, as we discussed. The word strike likely comes from sailors who would, quote, strike the sails. It's the sense of the word, not attack, strike, right? Even though it seems like it actually comes from the sense of to put down tools, to strike. You may hear the sense of this word in the term strike the set in theater work. Okay, enough of that. But can we infer from all this wordplay that even in ancient times, or relatively ancient times, when labor had grumbles, it didn't just sit idly by through human history and hope that things got better? Labor still has a powerful religious-like hold in American debate. Obviously more on the leftward side, if you use those terms. There are still key funders of the Democratic Party, ensuring that they have influence greater than their numbers, especially when one considers their assistance in primaries. Indeed, for a group that has maybe 15% of all workers, 7.5% of private sector workers, they still enjoy little over 40 to 50%, depending on the time the poll is taken, support in polls. Yet, there are critics. In the late 60s, Milton Friedman presented his view that labor was a harmful factor that created unemployment, took credit for increases that were not theirs. If you increase the price or cost of labor, like any other commodity, it limits the amount that can be bought. An employer can only buy so many workers. So, Friedman argues without saying it directly, call them scabs if you will. Block their entry if you must. But they are part of economics. They're people willing to work for less, to do the job 20% less of the labor cost, and provide more profit, more growth, more jobs, and perhaps more taxpayer money if we're talking about government union. Unions stop all this economic benefit from happening, according to Friedman. Another study of companies from 1961 to 2002 demonstrated that once a union election is won, the company's growth has declined. The study also shows something interesting, though, that companies actually are more likely to trim other costs before they trim profit going back to investors, assets, plant development, but perhaps hampering future growth, new bottling machine, or a new union contract, vacation plan, or a plant in the West Coast. These are the kind of choices that companies face. I've sang so many praises of unions and stories about workers being attacked and fighting for their rights that I feel I must give you all the critiques, because they don't end there. Unions, it said, cause cost-push inflation, drive jobs to non-union states, and they may be driving jobs to non-union countries. There are, of course, critiques to these critiques. Probably the best statement for union is the effect of unionized workers. They make more money clearly, and they're more likely to have health care and other benefits. No one disputes that. Is it right, one might argue, to apply Mr. Friedman's model of wage as price, like it's any other commodity, like an automobile or a banana, where a wage is the labor of a person? Do unions really reduce employment in any real way, or do they just prevent virtual slavery, where the bidding process would force wages down to a level that's near subsistence because there's no other choice for that worker? The stock market, for instance, can stop trading when there's a tremendous crash. They can stop or slow down trading. Is this all what unions do in the labor market, perhaps? If companies do make more profit, how much of that goes to growth? How much of it would really go to the bottling machine? And how much of it goes into the manager's pocket, into the CEO's pocket? If companies intend to go to India or China, once better transportation, information, and communication advances were made, would it really be the union at fault here? After all, when these countries, China and Philippines, have such a lower wage than even our non-union wages, aren't they just leaving America? In the child labor movement in history, unions have a historical role. The free market itself produced working children. In the eight-hour day, in the six-day and five-day week, in the concept of overtime and vacation, unions have a history. This vacation brought to you by America's unions? Okay, perhaps. But how much was the fight of the Wobblies or ancient blacksmiths, and how much was just a change in American culture? It's hard to argue the negative, that unions had no role. The eight-hour day came out of struggles, both against companies and political. And the amount of companies that match wages or benefits sans a union in order to avoid a union from ever developing may be even greater than those who did it because there was a sense of employee morale or recruitment. Companies like U.S. Steel or Ford that capitulated early to worker demands and provided a precedent for this culture. Was it the union movement that encouraged that? On the other hand, companies like International Harvester, where they were experiencing 72% turnover, dragged their feet on even establishing a vacation plan, despite the fact that their own employee company-sponsored union had brought that need to their attention. Unions represent, as we mentioned, just 15% of workers, 7.5% private sector in 2009. Trend is down half of what it was in 1985. Yet they enjoy tremendous sympathy support. 53% would support the so-called card check, which would mean that you could start a union merely by passing around the representation cards and having workers sign them rather than having a secret ballot election. And it really makes this not just a historical issue that's nice to talk about, but something that is really in the politics of today. This could be you. This could happen in your workplace or office. What do you think? Would you like a union or not? This is where I'll tell you what to think about unions. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that. I never do that in this program. I will give you 5 different ways to look at unions. I won't waste your time with the 2 extremes. If you absolutely love unions, what can I tell you? If you dislike unions intensely, I can't help much. Here's 5 other ways to look at it. Maybe you can blend them. One way may be to say that unions were a historical fact in America, but they are not needed now. Certainly, membership numbers in American unions would go in that direction, and the current manufacturing industry stats would go in your favor. There are a couple things you'd have to think about if you want this position. What about those few unions that are growing? I mentioned the SEIW. If it is a matter of history, do we owe anything to that historical legacy? Are we just going to say, thanks for the vacation? Don't really need you. A second way to think about unions may be, unions can be useful, but only where there is an employer who is extreme, who is trying to do things far below the average. And unions are declining because these type of employers are declining as well. You might have to deal with, if we get unions to such a low level that they no longer have any power, will they be utterly useless when such an abuser occurs? A third way to look at unions. It doesn't matter what you think or I think. Workers will organize like they always did through human history, right? I told you about striking was to strike the sales, right? Where there's work, there's organization. So you ban unions and workers are going to meet in the lunchroom and talk about some kind of action. So let it happen. With no government influence whatsoever in either direction. Don't ban unions. Don't allow employers to send in the police if union people are striking or protesting in a fair and nonviolent way. But also, don't use the law to elevate the status of unions. Now, if you look at things in this manner, the question you'll have, what if there's 5 unions that want to represent? Who decides? Could be a problem. What if one of those 5 is secretly a company-influenced union? Who decides? A fourth way to look at unions is they are simply political groups, and most of the benefits of unions come from influencing politicians, not strikes. So therefore, let's just be more honest and call them what they are. They are the labor lobby. Many of their benefits came from appeals to third parties who weren't either the employer or the workers involved in the strike. A fifth way to look at unions would be a consumerist way. At this point, the labor union movement is limited to very sympathetic situations, right? They are a form of social justice movement. Consumers can choose to buy or take services from companies that employ union workers because we are sympathetic to them. So we use our own consumer purchasing power to buy from these companies that are, quote, good. So we could say they're kind of like green companies, but of course we can't use that color it's taken. You can't use blue and red because they're political now. So call them orange companies. So I support unions and I'll only buy from orange companies where they treat their workers well. You know, Costco is an example of a company that has a really good reputation for how they treat workers. Claims would have to be verifiable. There'd have to be some standard to get that orange label. And I would suggest there might be a limit to how many companies could actually afford to be orange and reap that benefit. But there you go. 5 different ways to look at labor unions in the history of America. You can take a bunch of them. You can jumble them up. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We've got a Facebook site. And please, 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 if you like the program, write it up on comments on iTunes. Write it on the internet. Tell somebody about it. Thanks for listening.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.